The Tom Woods Show, episode 2390.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. This one is episode 2390 with our old friend CJ Kilmer, who hosts the Dangerous History Podcast. And let me tell you something. You know, first of all, does Dan Carlin still do his history podcast, as far as you know?
As far as I know, yeah. Although he only puts out like maybe one episode a year, which is even fewer than I do.
Oh, wow. Well, I remember it was pretty infrequent. But the reason I ask is that I know he would put out these very long episodes and he would put a lot of work into them. And so I've always thought of you. I've always thought like, well, you're like Dan Carlin. Your history episodes are long and rich and the result of an enormous amount of reading on your part. I think CJ is the hardest working guy in our movement who isn't a household name. So, you know, go send him a few bucks because I think it's true.
I appreciate that.
I'm sure you feel that way.
Yeah. Right? I appreciate that. And yeah, I try to mix in some shorter episodes here and there, you know, do some interviews
with
people.
Oh, sure.
And some episodes that are a little bit more off the cuff or whatever.
But you'll do a series of things like on Woodrow Wilson or World War I or whatever. And it's, wow, this is just what we all wanted and needed. And so you're doing a lot of the work that in order for us to acquire that knowledge, we would have had to spend an enormous amount of time. And you put all that effort in. So I hope you guys will check out Dangerous History Podcast and support CJ here. What's your website again?
If you just put in dangeroushistorypodcast.com, that will bring you to my homepage.
There you go. All right. Help out old CJ here. All right. Because he's helping you out. Okay. This is not a one-way street here. So we have rather an unusual topic today, but it's one that I thought when CJ proposed it, I think this one's a winner. So we are going to look at five different types of, I hate the word problematic now that the woke people have ruined it, but let's say difficulties or problems or what do we want to say? Problems with ways of thinking that the establishment would like us to have, but that we need to overcome. Like despite their best efforts, we have to not adopt these type of habits. So we want to go through these types of habits that they're kind of pushing us into having. But I wonder, again, I know this is a bit of a personal thing, so you don't, you know, you say however much you want to say, but how you came upon this particular topic is actually kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, so my degrees and official credentials are in history, but I've always been the type of person that's interested in a lot of different fields beyond just pure history. And I think that a lot of other fields have relevance to history. And one of the big ones, I think, is psychology. I think that by being someone who's always just been very interested in psychology and always interested to read books and articles on psychology, I think it's given me a broader kind of view on history than a lot of people have who have never really studied psychology. Because, of course, if you understand how people's minds work, then it's a little bit easier, at least, to try to put yourself in the shoes of some historical figure or whatever and try and figure out how things looked from their perspective and why they made the decisions that they made, including in cases where the decisions they made don't seem to make rational sense. But if you have an understanding of their psychology, it still might not be rational, but you can at least like understand it from a third-party perspective. And then I've dealt with mental health issues off and on my whole life, in particular depression. For a lot of my childhood and youth, I didn't really understand what it was. But looking back now, I can see whatever the exact formula of nature and nurture makes someone really prone to depression, I lost the lottery on whatever that mixture is. And I had probably the best year mental health-wise of my adult life in 2019. And then 2020 came along and bludgeoned me pretty good. And it didn't let up for the next 3 years. And basically, between spring of 2020 and early 2023, my depression was ratcheted up to certainly the worst it's ever been in my adult life, and possibly the worst it's been in my entire life. And ultimately drove me into having a drinking problem that I didn't have before 2020. And so over the course of this year, I've been battling those two things. And I'm over 6 months sober, and I've made progress on the depression. And, you know, I've been talking to a therapist regularly and also You know, I've got other friends and family, some of whom have mental health backgrounds, helping me out as well. And one of the many things I've done is cognitive behavioral therapy stuff. And I don't claim to be any kind of like a black belt expert in this stuff. I'm still very much a neophyte. But one of the things you do in cognitive therapy is you try and identify, and it helps to sort of have like a name or a label to stick on. You try to identify the negative thought patterns that you're prone to and to develop the skill to be able to, in real time, because if you're not aware of these things and what they are and what they look like, they'll tend to just run. It's almost sort of like having malware on your operating system is how I've described it. That your brain will kick into these negative loops. And typically we associate these cognitive distortions with leading an individual to different mental health problems, like especially anxiety and depression, probably the two most significant in the US and worldwide mental pathologies. So in cognitive behavioral therapy, you're trying to be able to sort of train yourself to identify these things when they start to run in your thought patterns and to try to develop strategies for breaking them up, questioning them, short-circuiting those loops. And as I've been learning more about what the common cognitive distortions are and how to spot them and examples of them, as you know, and many of your listeners may know, another thing that I've studied for many years and done podcasting and speaking on is propaganda. And so propaganda, really modern propaganda, comes out of like the coming together of psychology, advertising, and kind of like modern journalism. And if you look into like the key propagandists who really founded modern propaganda in the early 20th century, they usually have a mixture of those backgrounds, you know, people like Edward Bernays, for example.
Yeah.
And so I started to realize as I was learning these cognitive distortions that, oh, whether the practitioners of propaganda always realize it or not, and I think some of them do, if they've got a strong psychology background, a lot of times, whether explicitly or implicitly, they're trying to get you into cognitive distortions for one reason or another. And so all of these things that people getting help with cognitive behavioral therapy, all of these things that you're trained, you know, when you work with a therapist to try and spot in your own thinking and to try and avoid or disrupt, the establishment propagandists are trying to get you to, at least in regard to certain issues and questions and whatever, trying to get you to run this malware in your brain. And so I just thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. Then in a way, you could argue that establishment propagandists are deliberately trying to make you mentally ill because they're trying to inculcate thought patterns that distance you from reality and that are likely to lead you to a place of things like anxiety and depression.
This is such a fascinating insight that you've had as a result of your own looking into this, these types of matters, because of issues you've struggled with personally. I'll just say, during that 3-year period that you're talking about, I had you as a speaker twice at my, I've had an annual conference for my school life people here in Orlando, and you gave two absolutely top-notch presentations, and we interacted a fair amount and had dinner, and honestly, I had no idea what was going on in your life, and I'm glad things have made a turn, and I've, you know, we're friends on Facebook, so I know about things sort of looking up, but man, what they did to us over these past few years, I mean, it was rough on everybody, but there were certain people that really, really devastated, and this cannot ever just ever, ever be, oh, well, you know, nobody knew what to do, so they did the best they can. I generally am a let bygones be bygones type, not this time.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. This is the first time, you know, the way that this damaged me over the past 3 years, and I know many people had it much worse than me in various ways, and I think about how much worse off I would have been, because I actually did pretty good in 2019. I lost a ton of weight and got into very good physical health, and I certainly wish I had done more, but I made a lot of progress on my mental health in 2019. And so I think about even in my own case, if I hadn't had such a good year in 2019, how much even worse, if I was starting from a worse starting point in 2020, how much worse things might have gone for me.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that I feel like the people that I usually refer to just as the establishment, the individuals and institutions who really kind of rule us in various ways. This is the first time that I've really felt like I've personally been directly harmed by them. I knew it in an abstract sense before of like, yes, I'm being taxed to support wars and programs and things I don't agree with. And yes, I'm paying more money for gas and groceries because these SOBs at the Fed keep creating money out of thin air and whatever. But this was the first time I felt like directly.
Right. Also because we've paid taxes our whole lives. We've done these things our whole lives. Yeah, we notice it. It annoys us. But what they did over the past 3 years, now then we'd never endured anything like that. And that does hit home.
Yeah, in many ways, if you were trying to design like a program to maximize the mental illness of a population, you couldn't have done much better than the last 3 years. I mean, I suppose you could have ratcheted it up to extreme like Khmer Rouge levels of tyranny or whatever, but barring something like that, you couldn't have done much better. I mean, if I listed all of the things that I know will tend to amplify my depression, and then I look at what were the effects of like the COVID lockdown policies and everything like that, the list is almost identical. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Reduce social
yeah.
interaction,
oh, yeah.
increase stress. You know, it's like all
yeah,
the things.
Yeah, that's like a death sentence for some people.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't even lose my job. I just had my job transformed into hell for me anyway. And
yeah, yeah.
I didn't lose my family, but I had it stressed quite a bit. So yeah.
Yeah.
These people, in my opinion, should never be left off the hook.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I've got a printout from something you sent me. So let's start putting some specifics on this. Let's go through these. And so the first one of them, and you'll have to explain what these mean, and then we can have a conversation about them. I can guess what it is, but what's meant in this context by overgeneralizing?
Yeah, so overgeneralizing as a cognitive distortion is when you take, usually it's one example of a bad thing happening, and then your mind spins it into that's like always going to be the perpetual result of trying something. So for example, if somebody's dealing with a lot of social anxiety and is very phobic of social situations, having a hard time making friends and whatever, and then let's say they go into a social situation and it goes wrong in some way or just doesn't go as well as they had hoped. Maybe they go and ask somebody out and they get turned down or whatever. And then your brain spins that into, this always happens. I'm never going to make friends. I'm never going to get a girlfriend, a boyfriend, whatever like that. So just one or a few examples of something going bad, and then that's how it's always going to be. And I think that the kind of like the four biggest propaganda subject areas in recent years, one is COVID and everything to do with COVID. Another is Ukraine, Russia, all that stuff. Another is just Trump, like all things Trump. And then the last one is like wokeness as an umbrella for all the BLM stuff, the LGBTQ stuff, like all that, right? And so you could think of examples probably in all those four categories of this being sort of part of the establishment narrative. So, you know, it can often get you into a situation if you kind of let overgeneralizations run out of control. And this is true of a lot of these. It can get you into a victimhood mentality. And it can even get you into learned helplessness in a way. And so you point to one example of, I don't know, some white supremacist doing something nasty. And then in the woke propaganda narrative, this then is spun into, this is an irredeemably white supremacist society, and all of our institutions are fundamentally racist, and white people are eternally the oppressors, and non-white people are eternally the victims, or whatever. And you could argue, I suppose, that a lot of the, like the domino theory narrative about Ukraine, like we have to send $100 billion to Ukraine, otherwise they'll invade all of Europe and Russia will take over the world or whatever, is sort of like a version of that too, where they're saying, okay, this one example of Russia invading one country in its neighborhood, therefore is proof that Putin intends to take over all of Europe and eventually the world if we don't pull out all the stops in helping Ukraine.
Yeah. But so is this just an example of, in a way, kind of oversimplifying situations that we see examples of X and the examples of X indicate that this is a regularity of life and we have to draw a big conclusion of it. I mean, I can see how you could do that in your own life. You give the example of dating, but also I could see somebody who goes to a number of job interviews and gets, let's say after three or four of them, gets turned down and just becomes discouraged and thinks, well, I guess I'm going to be turned down at every single job interview I ever do. So I can definitely see that. I know a lot of people who have fallen victim to that. So this is what you mean in terms of how it would be applied, how it's being used against us in, let's say, the media?
Yeah. It's a way, I think, from the propagandist perspective, it is a way to sort of solidify divide and rule. And really, I think a lot of these serve that function. They might serve other functions too. But from the perspective of the elite propagandists, anything that can serve to keep the people who are being ruled divided into camps against each other is useful. And so if you can do this to turn members of like kind of regular middle and working class people against each other so that they're not looking up right at the people who are kind of ruling over and screwing over all of them. And then it's also a way to justify extreme responses to events. So instead of having a more kind of measured response to, say, Russia invading Ukraine and having a more nuanced understanding of it and maybe a more rational approach to like how to deal with it, if your goal is to, in the same way that the neocons did after 9/11, if your goal is to ratchet up the hysteria so that people are really eager for whatever crazy solutions you give them to the problem, right? Like we ought to be willing to run right up to the brink of World War III over the Donbass. That, yeah, overgeneralization is a, yeah, oversimplification certainly is another way to describe it, I think. Yeah, it's another way. And really a lot of these sort of overlap with each other in a way. And for sure, they all reinforce each other.
Oh, no doubt.
So if you can, if you're suffering from multiple of these, they're going to tend to negatively reinforce each other downward.
Yeah, well, if you're going to talk about the next one, emotional reasoning. Well, of course, that characterized the whole COVID thing because they would isolate one case and they'd say, look at this unfortunate person suffering in the hospital. And then they would want you to draw conclusions based on that one case. But the thing is, I could just as easily come back with my own emotional case of somebody who didn't get health care because they got displaced because of the COVID hysteria, and that person is suffering, then what? We're just going to trade these stories forever, and that's how we're going to make our decisions?
Yeah, and it's another way, kind of like with overgeneralization, it's another way to basically make anecdotal evidence seem like it's real proof. And, you know, the belief that your sort of subjective feeling about something counts as proof of the nature of that thing without doing any attempt at like objective empirical questioning or investigation, right? You hear the old cliche, like trust your feelings or whatever. That's terrible advice in many situations. I can tell you, as someone who's had a lot of mental health struggles, the last thing you want to tell someone who's suffering with real mental health issues is like, just trust your feelings. That's a great way to lead yourself into a downward spiral that ends in a very dark place. So
yeah,
one example that occurred to me of emotional reasoning being kind of cultivated and encouraged by establishment propaganda is this whole idea in sort of the woke sphere of lived experience, right? That lived experience is what really counts, right? Which we used to be willing to say, like, that's just anecdotal evidence that doesn't prove anything. So if one person perceives that they have been discriminated against or threatened or something like that, that's good enough, right? Or believe all women, whatever it is, where you're being basically told, if you're a person who's making huge claims about the white supremacist nature of American society or whatever it is, you're basically being validated in, oh yeah, your subjective experience of this is definitely the truth. And another one, I think, is that relates to the COVID sphere is when parents who are buying into the COVIDian narrative, when they're being not only not challenged, but like reinforced in their belief, which has been cultivated by the media, that COVID actually is a serious threat to their healthy 5 or 10-year-old child, and that therefore they're being a good parent by wanting to make sure that their 5-year-old is wearing a mask outside on the playground with other kids. And they're being a good parent to want to get their infants vaccinated or whatever it is like that. And there's no effort to do what a good therapist would sort of do in that situation, which is to try and introduce, as gently as they can, objective evidence to challenge your feeling of hysteria and fear, and to say, well, let's actually look at some hard data. How likely is it that your healthy 5-year-old is going to have a real problem if they do catch COVID? Or let's weigh the costs and benefits of this novel injection versus the likelihood that your 5-year-old is really going to have a problem if they do catch COVID. And so basically, it's like a way to manufacture moral panics or to create moral panics in the minds of people. Whether it's this notion that like white nationalism is the biggest threat to America, or that there's a trans genocide occurring or whatever like this. And the people who subjectively believe that just based on their own warped perception of reality, they're not being challenged. They're being reinforced in what essentially is a cognitive distortion and sort of, you could argue, a form of mental illness.
It's interesting how many things people were swept away by irrationally during this period, but yet, one thing that most parents turned out to be on the right side of was the question of the shots for their kids. Overwhelmingly, they just, and then boosters, that just went nowhere. That went nowhere. They were able, despite all the emotional appeals made, they were able to overcome those, at least a good chunk of parents, and just look at the raw data and say, the cost benefit makes zero sense here. So, I mean, that's a little bit of a white pill in the situation, I'd say.
Yeah, for sure. And you could see this in the response to January 6th as well, you know, that because you watched Yahoo's trespassing in some part of the Capitol building they weren't supposed to be in on TV, and if you're a blue pill chugging supporter of the establishment, you had a little emotional reaction to that. Therefore, you are validated in believing that, like, Trump tried to overthrow the government on January 6th. And a good friend of mine who's helped me a bit lately in a lot of my mental health issues, he has a professional mental health background. One of the ways he put this to me in talking about some of these that really resonated with me is he said, when you're in a state like depression and your mind is going into all these cognitive distortion thought loops, you have to think about it as if you're kind of like conspiracy theorizing that the whole world or the universe or something is conspiring against you. And in a way, if you want to try and unprogram those thought loops and avoid them, you have to debunk the conspiracy theories that your own brain is manufacturing about everything being against you and the world being against you. And again, I feel like establishment propaganda is doing the opposite of what a good therapist would do in this situation. They're telling you that like your cognitive distortions are actually a good thing and you're a good person for having them and that they are an accurate reflection of reality.
Hey everybody, let's say a quick word on behalf of our sponsor, Blinkist. Now, we've all met and seen people who are extremely impressive. They have an immense amount of knowledge, a command over one area after another of human endeavor. And you think, how can they possibly know all this and be so at ease with one subject after another? Well, one way you can secretly become that very person is with the Blinkist app. With the Blinkist app, you can absorb huge amounts of information in a very short amount of time. And this is the kind of information that satisfies your natural curiosity, like history and other fields, but it's also information to make you a better businessman, more successful in life, develop better habits. We're talking about 27 different nonfiction categories. And Blinkist will take bestsellers in these categories and summarize them for you. Each book is condensed into 15-minute summaries that you can read or listen to. And then you can decide, maybe I want to read this whole book after all. Or you can say, even these 15 minutes were excruciating to get through. And you're going to find great libertarian classics on Blinkist from Rothbard, from Friedman. Dare I say from Woods, there is indeed a Woods book on Blinkist. But also you can find, oh, here's where I find it particularly helpful when I'm driving around, is I do like personal development. But the problem is personal development books 98% of them are fluff. But I want that 2%. If I can get 2% of that book that actually gives you practical skills and knowledge and advice, that's what I want. And that's what the Blinkist version gives you. So right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. Now that's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Also, now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. So head over to Blinkist.com/woods. Your third one is exaggeration/minimization. So what's that about?
Yeah, it's sort of 2 sides of the same coin. And if you're in a state of anxiety or depression, one of the things that'll typically happen is that your mind will tend to exaggerate bad things and minimize good things. And to do this wildly out of any sort of sane proportion to reality. So you'll have a warped version of the costs and benefits of doing something. You'll have an exaggerated, and again, these kind of overlap. It's sort of a form of emotional reasoning, I guess you could argue. You'll have an exaggerated sense of the negative possibilities of doing something and minimized sense of the potential benefits. And even when something actually happens that's good to you, your brain will tend to want to minimize it. And if something bad actually happens to you, your brain is going to want to maximize that. So in the case of like how media propaganda will stoke this, it often comes out in the form of catastrophization, if I'm even pronouncing that correctly. Catastrophizing.
Catastrophizing, I think, has become a verb.
Yeah, this whole hysteria. So there's so many things in recent years that you could look at. And I think if you're looking at it calmly and objectively and rationally, you'd say, well, this is a threat, but you know, how big of a threat is it really? Like COVID, for example, right? It obviously is a threat. It obviously, getting it was really bad for some people. It obviously killed some people. But it's very easy, if all you're doing is consuming establishment propaganda about it, it's very easy to get a warped sense of just how dangerous it is, especially if you're a relatively young, relatively healthy person. And I don't have them at my fingertips, but I remember hearing about that somebody had done polling and asking people their subjective opinion or perception of like, how likely is COVID to kill you? And your perception, almost everybody had a wildly inflated sense of how dangerous it was in terms of likelihood to kill you if you catch it. But that there was a significant partisan divide where if you were a Democrat, you were much more likely to have even higher inflated mental numbers of how likely is COVID to kill you, how likely is COVID to hospitalize you, et cetera, like that. And so this is one that is very powerful because it plays into the whole concept of crisis and Leviathan. Because if you can exaggerate someone's fears about something wildly out of proportion to the likelihood that it'll happen and to the likelihood of how bad it'll be if it does happen. I even think back to in the aftermath of 9/11, where the media was basically trying to get everyone to think that 9/11 was going to just happen again and again and again, something of that magnitude, if we didn't invade this country, invade that country, allow these various violations of our civil liberties, allow the NSA to spy on everything we do. And they're giving you the impression that there's like an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent hiding under your bed and behind your door, just ready to jihad you as soon as you're not vigilant. And they sort of did a version of that with COVID, of trying to. And there was a great, I used to share this with my students back when I was teaching sometimes. There was a great list of things that are more likely to kill you than terrorism if you live in the US. And the list was extremely long and included countless things that like nobody is really scared of, and certainly no one is saying we should give up our rights for. I'm pretty sure most years slipping and falling in the shower kills more Americans than terrorism does. But, you know, nobody's saying, oh my God, if it saves even one life, we have to ban showers, right? Every single year, there's a 9/11 just on the streets of Florida, where you and I live. About 3,000 people die in vehicle accidents every year on the streets of Florida. That's the number of people that died in 9/11. And yet nobody is demanding that, at least hardly anyone is demanding that we just flat out ban cars. They might have, you know, crazy ideas about banning gas cars next year or something, but and certainly no one is demanding we give up our civil liberties because there's a 9/11 every single year on the streets of Florida due to motor vehicles.
Now, I realize this is not the point you're making, but in terms of how an individual copes with this problem, forget about the societal ramifications if we're talking about the propaganda machinery, but just how an individual deals with it. I sometimes give people advice about public speaking because I have a lot of experience with it. And as I'm sure you know, one thing people are terrified of for some reason is public speaking. And very often the reason is they catastrophize in their minds. They think, maybe I'll give the worst speech of the whole day, or maybe, you know, whatever will go wrong. And one way to help them in that situation is to walk them through. Let's imagine, now this doesn't work on the world stage, because on the world stage, the worst thing that could happen is global nuclear war. And that is pretty bad, right? Right. But if it's just a matter of you're going to go give a speech and you're terrified because you've thought through 89 different ways this thing can go wrong, I walk them through, let's walk through the catastrophe. Let's imagine you give the worst speech of the day, or you drop your notes and it takes you a few minutes to get started again, or you get nervous and you stumble. So what happens to you if that happens? What is the worst possible outcome? And the worst outcome is they give a bad speech, and by the next day, everybody has forgotten it. Or at least a month from now, nobody even remembers you. Okay, it's over. That's it. It happened, but that's the worst possible outcome. Now, then if I really am ambitious, I can talk to them about what the best possible outcome would be. But since they're already skeptical of their abilities, that may be a reach too far. But sometimes I ask them to confront the catastrophe and realize, yeah, it's painful and bad, but it's not life-ending. It's okay. And also, imagine when you've seen somebody give a bad speech, have you sat there thinking, that person is a piece of garbage who isn't worth anything? You've never thought that. You felt a little sorry. You thought, boy, that could be me. That's all that's going to happen. So sometimes staring the catastrophe head on can help you make progress because you realize it's survivable.
Sure. Yeah. And your mentioning of nuclear war as like an actual catastrophe, that actually made me think of something related to this that I think is an example of the media sort of doing both exaggerating on the one hand, but minimizing on the other in a warped way. So they'll perhaps exaggerate the threat of Russia to, say, Western Europe, let alone North America, in order to make Americans want to help Ukraine. They'll be like, oh, you know, if Russia wins in Ukraine, the dominoes will fall. And it's just like the old Vietnam domino theory again. And, oh boy, next thing you know, he's going to steamroll through Western Europe and invade America. And so on the one hand, they're ridiculously exaggerating the likely outcome of if Putin did win, whatever that means, in Ukraine. But on the other hand, those exact same people will usually minimize if you or I bring up the possibility of this thing escalating out of control into nuclear World War III, and they want to act like that's not even something you should care about. They're like, that's such a remote possibility, it might as well be zero possibility that that could happen. And so, you know, on the one hand, they're inventing this giant boogeyman catastrophe where it doesn't really exist. And on the other hand, they're minimizing something that may not be super likely, but is definitely a possibility.
It's not a likelihood of zero.
All you have to do is look at history, how often wars escalate out of control. Yeah, and considering the magnitude of if it does happen, yeah, so be terrified of COVID, even if you're young and healthy, but don't lose a moment worrying about nuclear war happening. That's not even something you should care about.
All right, how about all or nothing thinking? And I don't know what splitting is, so you'll have to help me.
Yeah, splitting is just another term that some sources use to basically describe all or nothing thinking. I think they're basically synonyms as far as my amateur non-psychologist's understanding. But basically, it's this, you know, any kind of like black and white or Manichaean sort of thinking. And this is stuff I was already talking about and kind of worrying about being inculcated in a lot of the population even before 2020 and everything since. I was already on my podcast back in, I think, late 2019, talking about the Manichaean mindset and how it can be dangerous and how it can be exploited by people who want to rule over you. But in an individual situation, it can often lead to perfectionism in various ways, which can be paralyzing and lead to procrastination. And it can also lead to self-sabotage. And the classic example is the person who, you know, is on a strict diet, falls off the wagon of their diet a little bit, you know, it's Friday night, they have a Sunday for dessert or whatever. And then they go, oh, to hell with this. I've already ruined my entire week of dieting. I'm just going to have nothing but junk food. Or I can't make it to the gym to work out for an hour, therefore I'm not going to do any exercise whatsoever. And so it's this classic case of kind of making the perfect the enemy of the good and sabotaging yourself. And I think that Manichaean thinking is encouraged by establishment propaganda in a variety of ways. And again, it's a way of cultivating a divide and rule strategy. It's a way of pitting groups of people against each other so that neither of them are looking at the people upstairs who are really kind of ripping them all off.
Right.
And it's a way, even I think, of preventing useful coalitions from forming. So the people, for example, who, I don't know, they hear, say, some libertarians hear about the RFK presidential bid and they say, well, RFK is bad on issues X, Y, and Z. Therefore, no libertarian should give him the time of day. That's, I think, an example of all or nothing thinking preventing a possible useful coalition from forming, right, of anti-regime factions, right, of saying, look, we may not agree with RFK Jr. or Vivek or whoever's a potential anti-establishment candidate or spokesman. We may not agree with them on every single issue, but we can agree with them on whatever, 3, 4, 5 really important issues right now. The rational thing would be, hey, can we make a coalition with some of these people over the really important issues of the day that matter the most, even if they don't agree with us on every single issue down the board? So I think that all or nothing thinking can be used to prevent, if you can inculcate it in the population, it can prevent broader anti-establishment coalitions of people who don't agree with each other on everything, but could agree on certain core issues from being able to come together. And another one that sort of just occurred to me where I think I've seen this is in the kind of anti-COVID regime, anti-vax community or population or whatever you want to call it. There are people who got vaxxed initially, maybe somewhat under duress in one form or another, maybe reluctantly, who now are having second thoughts, maybe are not getting any more boosters or whatever like that, maybe regret that they got it in the first place. And the purists, the people who never got vaxxed and whatever, some of them anyway, have this very condescending attitude that I've seen, where it's like, oh, you were dumb enough to fall for it once. And, you know, instead of taking the more like prodigal son approach of like, hey, you know, I understand why you would have been propagandized and pressured and steamrolled into getting it despite your misgivings. And now good for you for kind of seeing the lies and propaganda for what they are. And hey, kind of welcome aboard, so to speak, right? And instead it perpetuates this sort of like purity test, purity spiral kind of dynamic.
Well, I think you were kind of getting at something that I would amplify, which is that we see this in our own ranks, and this, it's self-imposed. And I have seen it certainly among libertarians. I mean, can you imagine how many people are hostile to Murray Rothbard? Just, he was just awful, they say. But you're telling me, okay, so you don't like anything he did? So his book on the Great Depression is worthless to you? And half these people don't even know he wrote a book on the Great Depression. So, you know, I don't know if that makes it worse or better. But, you know, he's got an amazing history of economic thought. He's got so much great scholarly work. It's so rare to hear people say, you know, I think Rothbard was really good on A, B, and C, but I think he really went off the rails when it came to D, E, and F. Hmm. What's so hard about that? Why are people incapable of that? And I see that in my own life. Now, I know it's hard to believe that an amiable guy like me would have enemies, especially in the libertarian world. But the libertarian world, unfortunately, there's a sliver of them that they're just they're crazy. And yet, you would think, since we do have at least something in common, all of us as libertarians, that people could look at me and say, well, you know, he's obviously paid his dues in this movement. You know, he's produced a lot of content and he's written some books and some of it has some value. But I really think his emphasis is all wrong. I mean, I could accept that, but it's like the response is that I must just be thoroughly evil. Like, not one thing I've done has pleased you. Nothing. Like, nothing I said about the Fed during the 2008 crisis. None of that was any good. So this is a thing that I've had to go out of my way to show people that I don't go for this, that I do the opposite. I really genuinely try to find overlap with people. And then I get accused of being not a good enough libertarian because I like this person because he's good on seven things. At this point, I don't even care about any of this anymore. I just want to do what I think is right.
Yeah, I've often thought that I probably could have built up a bigger audience faster to my show if I had just been willing to play into Manichaean thinking, because I think human beings are kind of evolutionarily hardwired to respond to it, I think, because of our kind of evolution as tribal primates. We have this like desire, most of us, to want to think in terms of us and them, you know, pure white, pure black, you're my best friend or my worst enemy. And people respond to it. And that's why very often politicians with that sort of rhetoric get a bigger following than politicians who take a more kind of level-headed approach that is much more about nuance and subtlety and whatever. And yeah, kind of a like a nuance and subtlety dork where, you know, I dig into these things and I mean, maybe I make a partial exception for Woodrow Wilson, but like there's relatively few historical figures that I can't find at least one or two redeeming qualities for, even if they're horrible on a lot of things. And very often I get into, I'll give you just one example that I got into a bit years ago, which is I did a big, long, many, many hour series on the American Civil War. And a lot of my take was very revisionist, very anti-establishment narrative. But very often it seems like people who start to accept some of the criticisms of the Lincoln administration and why he went to war and some of the things he did over the course of the war, et cetera, they then go to the opposite extreme of wanting to turn it into, therefore, the Confederacy and the Confederates were all great guys and, you know, we have to like put them on a pedestal as these noble libertarian heroes and whatever like that. And my approach was much more subtle, much more nuanced of, look, I'm against most of what the Lincoln administration did. At the same time, I'm not going to cheerlead for the Confederates and pretend that they were something they were not, in the same way that I can be totally against what the federal government did in regard to Randy Weaver or the Branch Davidians. That doesn't mean that I have to then be an apologist for those people. It doesn't necessarily mean they were great people, but they didn't deserve what was done to them. In the same way that I can be against the U.S. supporting Ukraine in this war, it doesn't mean I think Putin's a great guy or I want him to live, or sorry, I want him to win. But, you know, that's how most people want things. And that's why if you look at a lot of the most popular commentators in the mainstream, they're very often like the Sean Hannity, like very simplistic Manichaean type of people who are just like, well, what did the dumb liberals do? And we're the noble conservatives. And those are the only two flavors that exist. And those are the only two options. It's us versus them.
I have a friend, maybe some of you know who it is, but I don't think he would mind if I gave this example, but I think it would be tacky. But I have a friend who wrote a book whose purpose was to say that both sides have it wrong. So he was trying to take a libertarian tack and say both sides have it wrong. And I warned him. I said, now, if you want to write that book because it brings you intellectual pleasure and you would just on principle like to have it out there, I have no objection to that. But it's not going to sell because nobody wants to read that both sides are wrong. They want to read my side is right, the other side is wrong. He said, oh, I don't think that's true. Well, the book did not move at all. And he actually wrote me a letter and said, I should have listened to you. You were right. And I don't want to be right. I took no pleasure in being right about that. People should read a book like that. But unfortunately, you have to, you know, this is one of those cases where you'd like people to be different from how they are, but you may have to accommodate yourself to how they are. And in fact, there's one other quick book example of this. So I wrote Meltdown in 2009 about the financial crisis of 2007 and 8. And for that book, I had a whole title and subtitle worked out, and they just threw that out. And they had this subtitle about how this book is a free market look at the crisis. And I objected to that. I said, well, maybe it is, but I don't intend it to be just for free market people. I want the general population to read this book. And I think this will drive them away. They'll think it's just ideologically driven. And they told me that it was very noble of me to want to reach the whole general public, but I would reach nobody with my subtitle, and at least they would reach the free market people with theirs. You know, and that's who and where we are at this point.
Yeah, well, the way that I've, and maybe this is self-serving, but the way that I've kind of explained away the fact that I tend to look for complexity and subtlety and nuance in the way that I analyze and explain history is I'll say that I'm not trying to be a broadcaster. I'm trying to be a narrowcaster. And so I'm trying to speak to the niche that actually wants to hear where I'm coming from. And so I kind of look at it as, and maybe I'm completely wrong in coming up with justifications to explain away my horrible blunder, but I see it as, yeah, most people want a super simplified, easy, like the equivalent of like the neocon narrative of Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin kind of thing, where it's a super simple comic book, and not even like comic books modern, but like 1950s comic book understanding of the world and good guys and bad guys and whatever. And my thinking is like, yeah, if I did more of that in my coverage of history, I might have built a bigger audience, but it's not the audience I want. I want the audience that maybe is smaller, but actually is interested in trying to understand all the complexities and subtleties and whatever like that. And if that means that I've got a lower ceiling in terms of my audience, so be it. You know, I don't necessarily want to reach the people that would be responsive if I tried to appeal to everybody.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, how about this last one? What is personalization / blaming?
So in a mental health context, my understanding is that they kind of refer to the same phenomenon, but sort of different sides of the coin. So my understanding is that in personalization, you're sort of blaming yourself for things, even if you don't deserve the blame, or maybe you only deserve a small portion of the blame, and there's a lot of other factors behind it or whatever. So when you're personalizing, it's when something doesn't go the way you want it to or the way you think it should, and then you interpret that as it's entirely your fault for some reason. And so in a way, it's also sort of like a version of catastrophizing, I suppose. So I don't know, a person tries to win some contest and doesn't win, and then just puts the blame entirely on themselves and goes into like a depressive loop of kicking themselves. And maybe it goes all the way to the point of, I'm just, you know, completely worthless. I'm a complete failure. I'm a loser, whatever. And it could be that there are a whole bunch of reasons why things didn't go the way you wanted it to. And maybe none of it has to do with your own shortcomings, or maybe only a little proportion of it does. And then blaming is sort of the opposite, same phenomenon, but in the opposite way, where you are placing the blame entirely outside of yourself. So you're blaming others. So things don't go your way and you blame a particular individual, or you blame a particular group for the reason that things didn't go the way you wanted them to, or that you failed at something that you thought you should have succeeded at. And so this again is a path that tends to lead to kind of a victimhood mentality being cultivated, and maybe even to the level of learned helplessness in a way. So any type of propaganda that's seeking to, on the one hand, it could be trying to get you to internalize feeling the blame for something not working, right? So, oh, you know, the reason that the COVID rates are spiking is that not everybody got on board with masking and vaccine and whatever else it might be. Those people are the reason that, you know, and you can see this even in some of the propaganda where they were trying to make people feel guilty for catching COVID in some cases, right? Where it was,
that's
almost
exactly
like
what I thought of when you brought up this example or this category. That's exactly the thing I thought of, was that it's my fault. Maybe I had my mask off for 10 seconds. What did I do wrong? I wasn't following the recommendation, whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And a lot of this also, I think, has overlap with something that I've spoken about before, including at the School of Life event back in January of this year, I think, which is the way that cults use a lot of the same techniques that propagandists use. And so, yeah, this method of getting people to internalize things and blame themselves and feel guilty themselves for causing a problem that maybe they had nothing to do with, or maybe there was nothing. Something like a highly contagious respiratory virus, people are going to catch it. Just most people are going to catch it sooner or later, regardless of what mitigation strategies they're doing. And yet there's this reflex to moralize it and to turn it into like, well, what sins did you commit that could possibly have led you? Because only bad people and negligent people get this virus, right? So what sins against the orthodoxy have you committed here?
Yeah, I've got so much of that in the book that I have coming out. And it was interesting to see the governor of Nevada, Sisolak, I think is how you say his name. I can't remember. But the governor of Nevada had made a statement that, look, people, the numbers are going back up again, and I am not going to tolerate this. And we'll reexamine in 2 weeks. And if they're not better, there are going to be consequences. I mean, he's treating everybody like they're seven. 3 days later, he tests positive. 3 days later, he tests positive. And he says, I don't know how I got it. I followed all the recommendations. So, oh, okay. So you're going to take back the speech you just gave us about, you know, how we're going to be punished if we don't do the right thing. It really was. That's why my book, forthcoming book, has the word psychosis in it. Because it was a psychosis.
It was. It was deliberately cultivated atmosphere of hysteria and moral panic. And you can see it being used in other areas as well when, I don't know, a big storm or natural disaster happens and the media wants to say, oh, it's because we still drive gasoline-powered cars and don't have enough windmills providing our electricity. It's all your fault or those sorts of things. And anytime, I suppose it's also kind of a form of projection in a way too when you're blaming some third party for something. And so one that occurred to me is when Biden referred to rising gas prices and other rising prices as Putin's inflation, right? And wants to say like, oh yeah, the only reason you're experiencing higher prices is because Vladimir Putin is evil Hitler part two. And for sure, the one thing that has nothing to do with rising prices is monetary policy.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The one thing that we know for
that's
sure.
Right.
Just like when a 20-year-old athlete dies suddenly, the one thing we know for sure definitely didn't
is that
do
it is
the
not
vaccine.
The thing
Couldn't
you're thinking.
Else, but definitely not that.
It's not the thing you're thinking. Yep. It definitely is not that.
Yeah, so it's another way to project and deflect and guide people away from the wrong answers and to your right answers.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, this is all very interesting stuff. You really put this all together, and you're right. This is like the perfect storm of creating a populace. Like you're basically, what you're doing is building on tendencies that may be there already, and that some people have managed to regulate better than others, but you're going to draw them out. And instead of trying to fix them or sublimate them or come up with replacements for them, you're going to entice people to almost luxuriate in them, to bring them out even more. And the result is this mad society we have now where nobody can speak in terms of subtleties. And we really feel like we're in a war. Now, parentheses, I think we are in a war. But some of the over-the-top nature of it was entirely avoidable. The way they've portrayed Trump or the way they've portrayed this or that. The other thing, it's pitted people against each other who really probably could have more or less gotten along in the past. And they did get along in the past. Now this is where we are. But at least we, you know, as I say, with a conversation like this, we're able to kind of tease out and understand a little bit what the ingredients are in getting us into this kind of situation. Now, of course, let me get rid of all the subtlety for a minute and say, if we didn't have evil commies all over our society, we would also not have this problem. But there are a lot of ingredients, I'll say. Remind people one more time, CJ, about your website. You mentioned it at the beginning.
Yeah, dangeroushistorypodcast.com will take you just to my homepage, my website. And if you want to listen to my show, I've done a little bit of video, but mostly audio. I want to do more video in the future. But wherever you consume your audio podcasts, if you just look up Dangerous History, you'll probably find it right away. And I've covered all kinds of stuff. The next big one that I'm working on is my next Woodrow Wilson episode. And that's going to be covering the period of quote-unquote neutrality in World War I. So looking at the Wilson administration from the outbreak of the war in Europe until he gets the U.S. into the war in the spring of 1917. So that's the next big, like you were saying towards the beginning, those long narrative kind of Dan Carlin-esque episodes. That's the next big one that I'm working on currently.
That's excellent. Excellent. Well, we will look forward to that very much. CJ, thanks so much for your time today, and I appreciate all your insights as always.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.